Welcome to Shoot First, Ask Questions Later, where we research the response of our past and review their relevance for today. This is your host, Moshe Kurtz. Welcome, my friends, to another episode of Shoot First, Ask Questions Later. Today, we are joined by Rabbi Gil's student, and we are going to be talking about a tshuva of the Maharik and the unfortunate case of an inadvertent infidelity. Rabbi Gil's student is the editor of TorahMusings.com, a leading website on Orthodox Jewish scholarly subjects, and the book editor of the Orthodox Union's Jewish Action magazine. He writes a popular column on issues of Jewish law and thought featured in newspapers and magazines, including The Jewish Link, The Jewish Echo, and The Views. In the past, he has served as the president of the small Jewish publisher Yasher Books and as the managing editor of OU Press. Rabbi Student serves as the director of the Halakha Commission of the Rabbinical Alliance of America and is also currently serving his third term on the Executive Committee of the Rabbinical Council of America. He has published 4 English books and is currently preparing for publication. Points of Contention, celebrating 20 years of controversy and debate on the Hirhurim Torah Musings website. It should be B'Shah Tova Mutzlachas. And I have to give hakaras hatov to you, Rabbi Student. I can't say I've made much of a dent of a contribution to Torah Musings, but I believe Torah Musings for English language halacha online is perhaps one of the best repositories. If you're looking for some kind of contemporary halacha or anything of that sort, Torah Musings should be one of your first addresses. So, Rabbi Student, it's an absolute schus and privilege to have you with us today. And also, I have the makar tov that you are going to be our first guest unpacking a tshuva of the Maharik. So maybe you want to just tell our listeners and myself who the Maharik was and why we are going with this particular tshuva today.
Sure, Rabbi Kurtz, thank you very much for inviting me to this podcast. It's an honor and a pleasure. As you mentioned, I've been writing on Torah Musings and blogging and all that I do for 20 years now. And you've been a part of that for a year when you had your regular column. And it's just been such an amazing experience, a life-changing experience, and I hope I've contributed somewhat to some people's learning, but it's also very much enhanced my own learning. And I wouldn't be here if not for that. You wouldn't even have invited me. So let's get to the topic, because we have half an hour to discuss this amazing tshuva of the Maharik. The Maharik was named Rav Yosef Cologne. He lived in the 1400s in Italy. Actually, he was born in France. He was part of the Ashkenazic tradition from France, and they moved to Italy because of persecution. In the 15th century, there was continuing persecution in France and in Germany, while Italy was going through the Renaissance. And for a large part of the 15th century, there was peace among the Italian city-states, and there was a huge influx of Jews from France and Germany and from elsewhere. There were medical schools in Italy. There were allowing Jews to go to medical school. There were a lot of young people. There was really intellectual ferment in that whole place. And Maharik was really, he was educated by his father. I don't know if he even went to yeshiva, but his father was one of the Gedolei Hador. And Maharik was just an ilui, a genius, a child prodigy. And because he had no formal pedigree, he started off as a melamed. He taught little kids. But quickly, people realized that this guy's a genius. He was appointed the Rav and the Rosh Yeshiva in Pavia in Italy, and his yeshiva flourished because he was just so amazing. People flocked to him. And in terms of halacha, people started sending him questions from all over the place because they really appreciated his analysis and his answers. So he was getting shilas from Germany, from France, from Sephardic countries, because Italy is on the Mediterranean. So you also have Sephardic influence there, and Spain is not that far away either. So this particular tshuva I find fascinating. I first learned about it in yeshiva because it's very lumdish. It has a lumdish quality to it. It's quoted lahalacha and Shulchan Aruch, and the poskim debate it constantly because it is an incredible stringency. It's a real chumrah. It's compelling, intellectually compelling, but in this, when we're talking about infidelity, and we'll get to it in a minute, we just as rabbis, you want to be as lenient as possible to keep families together. There's a tshuva of the Trumas Hadeshin who quotes the Maharan Rutenberg, who says that when it comes to keeping families together, we're very makel. We want to keep families together. Even other areas, Maharan Rutenberg was machmir, but you know that's just a general rule. Just like when it comes to agunas, we try to be makel as possible. So too here, and as we'll see, the Maharik has a chumrah, but it's very hard. Nobody ignores the Maharik. Everybody discusses it. We'll talk a little bit about some of the reception history, how later postgame talk about the Maharik, but some people like it, some people don't. You can't ignore it.
Right. I appreciate what you're doing here, which is many of the, you know, the theme of the many of the tshuvos I've noticed that people have brought on the podcast is usually, and Rabbi Ploni Almoni has this major chiddush and kula, which swoops in and saves the day. And I kind of like what you're doing over here, which is, sometimes the tshuva actually doesn't wind up what we call, quote, saving the day. Sometimes it does have a more machmir conclusion. So this is, I think this is a good lesson in that, even though, as you'll point out in the reception history, even though the Maharik is someone who needs to be reckoned with, he's not the final word, per se.
Yeah, I think that's well said. And as we'll see, it's not only his subject and his conclusion and his arguments. He also uses an unusual methodology, which strikes me as a little bit shocking, a little scandalous. Yeah. But once you take a step back, you realize maybe it's not so bad. It's actually so. Let's get started. The case, we don't know the exact case before the Maharik that came to him, and it's that's also surprising because it's really strange. There's the shaila. The question is, a married woman committed adultery, but she thought it was halachically permissible. She thought it was mutter. Set some background. When the Gemara in Sota Chav Zayin Amud Beis, that when a woman, an Eishes Ish, a married woman, commits adultery, she is forbidden to her husband and she's forbidden to the man she committed adultery to. They have to get divorced and she can't have an affair and then marry that guy after she gets divorced. Doesn't work that way. Halacha doesn't allow that. It's a Surah Labal and a Surah Laboel. The other thing to know, though, is that there's a discussion in Gemara and Shabbos about Omer Mutter. If someone thinks something is Mutter and you do it, what are you? Are you considered, you do it intentionally. You intend to turn the light switch on, but you think turning the light switch on is Mutter. You don't know that the halacha doesn't allow it. So are you a shogeg? Are you a mazid? What are you? So generally we paskin that Omer Mutter is shogeg. If you think it's mutter, you're considered a shogeg. You only accidentally commit the sin.
Mm-hmm.
So you think if a woman commits adultery thinking it's halachically permissible, she should be omer mutter. She thinks it's mutter, and she's a shogeg, and therefore she's allowed to remain married to her husband. That rule of asur labal, asur laboel doesn't apply because she's shogeg. It was an accident.
Right. So the issue is that it's ambiguous as to what piece of data she was missing. The Rama himself, quoting the Maharik, makes that distinction, which is either shesavra shebayelahu, did she think that this man was her husband, or she just thought it wasn't her husband, but it was not znus for her to engage in this act.
It's very hard. So the case of if she thinks it's her husband, that's actually mentioned in a Gemara. That would be a clear shogeg. But here it sounds like the Kala teacher just never told her this is not allowed. I mean, it's really weird.
We're going to cover that one.
So later tshuvas actually tell us different cases where this is applied to, and they're mind blowing. Here's the shem. We'll get to it. But how does the Maharik answer his question? The answer is he quotes a pasuk in Parshas Naso when he's talking about a sota. The pasuk says umala vo mal. It's Bamidbar Perikay pasuk Yudbeis umala vo mal. The wife, rebelled against her husband, or she betrayed him. And the key word is bo, him, not ba Hashem. She didn't rebel and betray Hashem. She betrayed her husband. That's the Maharik focuses on that. And he says, so you see, if it was a betrayal of Hashem, so she thought it was mutter, so that would be a shogeg, and she wouldn't be asur to her husband. But here, she betrayed her husband knowingly, intentionally. She just didn't realize it was halachically forbidden. And since it was a betrayal to her husband, and let me take a step back, by the way. When I use the words like betray, when we're talking about infidelity, there are real people listening to this podcast. And I just want to emphasize, a lot of emotions. People who have been involved in cases like this and situations, there are a lot of emotions that surround it. And I'm not trying to be insensitive to that. And every case is different. Everybody needs to talk to their own rabbis and their own, mental health professionals. So let's put that aside. I hope nobody gets offended or triggered in any way by what we talk about. But if in a case of adultery, of infidelity, one spouse betrays the other, every circumstance is different. But since this woman, when she committed adultery, bishogeg, infidel, she was infidel. She thought it was mutter, but she still knew she was. It was not her husband, and therefore, says the Maharik, that is a case in which she is usher to her husband, and it still applies. And therefore, says the Maharik, they must get divorced. Now, in real cases, by the way, Rabbi Kurtz, real cases, the details matter. If you go to a rabbi in such a case, the rabbi is going to say, "Well, what's the evidence? Do you believe?" There are all sorts of circumstances. And like we said from the Maharunberg, we try very hard to keep families together when they want to stay together. There's a lot of work to be done. Nobody should be passing based on this. But in the Maharik's case, he said that they have to get divorced.
Right. So this inference from the Pasuk, is this rooted in a Gemara or Maimer Chazal, or is this the Maharik himself suggesting this close reading and inference?
That's later poskim say. Who does he think he is? There's no Midrash, there's no Mishnah, there's no Gemara, no Mechilta, nothing like that. It's a Maharik reading a Pasuk and making his own drasha.
Wow.
And right, it's a little scandalous.
And with real consequences. It's not just like a – I remember I learned through a Sevelovsky share at YU for 2 years, I think it was. So he'd always say, you know, that's a nice Shabbos morning sermon topic, but it's not a real drasha. So – but here – It's what you would have said was parshanut, was a nice Shabbos morning sermon, but here it has real halachic consequences in a very high stakes area of Jewish law.
It's astounding. And to make matters even worse, so this is something that the Chida pointed out. The Chida is Rabbi Chaim Yosef David Azulai in the late 18th century in Israel. Genius, photographic memory, knew everything. So he points out in a tshuva, the Maharik himself in a different tshuva. We've been talking about, by the way, Maharik Shorish Kuf Samach Zayin. Simon 167. In Kuf Lamed Tes, the Maharik himself yells at someone else who quotes, he quotes a pasuk, Yavama Yavo Aleha. There's a positive mitzvah for a Levirate husband to marry, to marry the woman, the Yavama. We're not going to go into all that, what that means. And if she marries someone else, so this guy said, velo acher, so it's a mitzvah asay, she can't marry someone else. And the Maharik says, who do you think you are, making a drasha from a pasuk that doesn't appear anywhere? No, it's an iser, it's a lav. You can't just make your own drashas. So says the Chida, what do you mean? The Maharik in Kuf Lamed Tes is yelling at someone for making his own drasha, but in Kuf Samach Zayin, he himself makes his own drasha, umala vomal.
Right. Sounds like a bit of projection over there.
You have to answer it. The Maharik was no small man. The Maharik was great, the greatest of his generation. He's quoted by the Ramah, the Shulchan Aruch, all the poskim. You can't just say he was sloppy. Right. So the Chida answers, you have to distinguish between making a drasha, deducing something from a pasuk, trying to draw it out. That we can't do. That's a Chazal thing to do. We don't make our own deductions using the Yud Gimel Midosh Torah Nidreshes Bayan. We don't do that. But you're allowed to read a pasuk and say, that is what Hashem wants from me. And all the Maharik is doing is reading the pasuk. Uma'ala v'omal. That's the pasuk. He doesn't make any drasha. He says, that's the pasuk. I'm reading the pasuk. And he's not the only one to do that. When you look into it, so for example, Rav Avram ben Arambam does this consistently in what we have of his Perish Al HaTorah. We have Reishis and Shmos. He does it consistently to be machmir, meaning he knows what Chazal says. What Chazal read in the pasuk is halachically binding. But if he reads a pasuk and he sees something else in there, he says, you know what? We got to follow that also. Mm-hmm. He'll read a pasuk kipshuto, pshat. The Rav Avram ben Arambam will read pshat in the pasuk and be machmir based on that. So for example, it says v'ger lo sonu. You're not allowed to oppress a ger. And Chazal, the Gemara Bava Metzia, reads that as talking about a Ger Tzedek, a convert. We're not allowed to oppress a convert. We're not allowed to suppress anybody, any Jew, but a convert even more. And the Rav Avraham Ben Arambam says, but Pashup Pshat is talking about a stranger, not necessarily a ger, any stranger, Jewish, non-Jewish, anyone from anywhere who's not in their normal place, they're vulnerable and you can't oppress them. Yes, the drasha is true, because what Chazal say is halachically binding, it is correct on the drash level, but the pshat level is also halachically binding, at least the chumrah.
So you're saying when they use this and use v'haftarecha kamocha at the immigration rallies, you're saying that they have what to be somechan?
to be machmir. To be machmir.
Right. So here's the thing, So I don't know if the Maharik is as radical as we're making him out to be, because the Hemshech, the continuation of the tshuva, he then puts forth other arguments based on readings of the Gemara to support his psak. So it sounds almost like this pasuk is a sniff or a remez, but his entire analysis doesn't hinge solely on his interpretation of the pasuk.
I agree with you 100%, and he does. We'll talk in a minute about one of his knockout proofs that he has. But the core, I think the core is this pasuk, and then he brings proof from the Gemara to show that it's correct. And even though there's no drush of Chazal must have been assuming this. Mm. And let's go straight to the proof, because we're...
Oh, yeah, and like, you know, with Purim coming up, I mean, I love that you chose this tshuva. With your Ruach HaKodesh, something to do with Esther and Mordechai, one of the popular sugyos.
Exactly. So with the run-up to Purim, it's perfect timing. So I think we should give a little background here. The Gemara in Megillah, Tesvav Amar Aleph, talks about, first of all, Esther and Mordechai were married, which is not obvious from the Megillah. And then, I remember once, it occurred to me that the Megillah's Esther is really a story about intermarriage. And it's so strange that we would be celebrating the story of intermarriage because Esther was married to Ahasuerus, who wasn't Jewish. But when you look in the Megillah, it's very, very clear. This was not her choice. It always says, Vati lokach, Esther. Every single place, Esther was taken. She was forced into it. It's not like she voluntarily intermarried. She was forcibly taken and forced to be the wife to Ahasuerus.
No, at the beginning of the story.
Right. And there's one time where that changed. And when Mordechai tells Esther about Haman's plot, evil plot, and Esther says, and tells her, you have to go to Ahasuerus and you have to plead our case. And she says, wait, but then I'll be going willingly. The way the Gemara reads it, I'll be going willingly to Ahasuerus, which means I will be committing infidelity, you know, intentionally. Mm-hmm. She could have just stayed away from Ahasuerus as much as possible, but she's actually going to him, and she knows what's going to happen when the queen goes to the king. And they read, they understand the pasuk kasher avadti, to mean, okay, that means I'm not going to be mutter to Mordechai anymore. That's what I'm losing. She's losing her husband by going to Ahasuerus to plead the Jewish case. She's losing her husband.
Right, and Marik says, and you know, chaser shalom, that we would ever think that cast aspersions on the intention and kavana of Esther at the loftiest of motivations and intentions. And nonetheless, we say, kasher avadati, she still couldn't go back to Mordechai because it was categorically adultery at that point.
Right. So the Maharik says, even if the infidelity is a mitzvah, it is ma'olavo ma'al. She is betraying her husband. And she becomes osur to him. So he says, in our case also, even if she didn't know what she was doing, it might not have been an avera, might not have been a sin, but it still was a betrayal of her husband, and the woman should be offered to her husband.
Right. The line at the end of the tshuva, just he spells it out in such clear terms. V'alo dvarim kal v'chomer, u'ma hasim dola hayib davar shum ninu d'avera, ela adar b'mitzvah ka'avda. Right? You said she was, not only was she not doing an avera, she was doing a mitzvah for everyone, to save the Jewish people. So certainly in the case of Isha Shizinsa Tachas Baya Lo Kol Shekein She Yesu Her Love, certainly in this case where she didn't have exactly the loftiest of intentions, and now we're just darshaning technicalities, it would stand to reason that Kal Vachomer, she would not be permitted back to her husband if Esther herself and Tzadikus couldn't be.
And like we've been saying before, this is really a tough pill to swallow, to think that. And you know what? Let's go straight to another tshuva of the Shvus Yaakov. The Shvus Yaakov was a Yaakov Reicher at the early 1700s in Germany. there was, and he actually gives a case of what it would be to have an inadvertent infidelity. And there's a group of Jews traveling. They went to a hotel, including a husband and wife. Mm-hmm. And when they got to the hotel, a bunch of non-Jews, Germans, really a bad crowd, started getting violent with them and threatened to, and probably were going to kill them all. And this woman, with her husband's permission, her husband's consent, I mean, everybody's consent, seduced the leader of the pack. And because of her seduction, as she slept with him, everybody got to live. The group backed down and didn't try to kill them anymore. So the case is, did she do something wrong? She saved everybody's life, but it was adultery. It was infidelity. And the Shvat Yaakov says that's the case of the Maharik. Essentially, it's onus. It's coerced. She was forced into it. She didn't do it willingly, which is perhaps even better than Esther, who went willingly. This woman didn't do it willingly, she said, to save everybody's life. But Lamaisa, umala vomal, it wasn't her husband.
Right. It's not a matter of kavana, it seems almost. It's just categorically, objectively, something took place. It's not a matter of intent. It's a, what do you call it, like strict liability. I forget what the legal terms for these things are, but that seems to be the case. So what's the, just tell us, what's the reception history? Is the Ma'arik accepted la halacha? I see it's quoted in the Ramah, but I'm sure there's more conversation following that.
So the Ramah in Evin Ezer Kufayin Ches Gimel, so he quotes this Ma'arik la halacha. The Mefarshim, some of them accept it, some of them don't. Even on the page of the standard Shulchan Aruch, so there's a big Reb Shlomo, there's a big Chokhmah Shlomo at the bottom by Reb Shlomo Kluger, and he argues with it. The Shvus Yaakov, though, he defends it. There are other tshuvas before. The Shvus Yaakov quotes a tshuva's base Yaakov, who disagreed with the Maharik, and the Shvus Yaakov rejected. The Shvus Yaakov is very important in halachic history, and he was convinced by it. And the Shvus Yaakov, he distinguishes. He makes an important distinction, a lumdish distinction, about where there's an onus. Is the onus on the act, or is the onus on the circumstance? Mm-hmm. If there's onus is on the act, that's rape. A woman is not, that's not infidelity at all.
Right.
If the onus is on the bigger circumstance, like this woman who tried to save her traveling party through the infidelity, so that there's no onus on the act, and therefore the act is not considered onus. It's considered mazid. She did it intentionally, even though there were bigger circumstances, the onus doesn't apply to that.
Wow. So do we know how modern day poskim fall out on this one, how they rule? Or is this like kind of, I mean, naturally these are all private cases, but do any poskim kind of go on record as to which way they may poskim in these cases?
I can get closer to modern day.
Okay.
So the Binyan Siyan, Rabbi Yaakov Edlinger in the 1800s in Germany. So he had a case. This is a wild case. This is Rabbi Kurtz. This is a wild case.
Okay.
Binyan Siyan.
Buckling up.
Kuf Nun Dalid. Okay, this woman lived in a village. She was a small village. Her husband had to travel away for work, but she was there with her kids, with the house servants, and someone came knocking on the door. Traveling Jew, look all all travel weary, asked for a place to stay. So he stayed with them, and then he started talking with over a few days, he started talking with the woman of the house, explaining that he's Eliyahu Hanavi.
Oh, this one.
And, if she sleeps with him, not only will she have Mashiach, she give birth to Mashiach, she will also, if she waits till Tuesday and she opens up her cabinet, she'll find it's full of gold coins. So he appealed to her idealism, and he appealed to her basic greed. And she was thrilled by the idea. The guy had a few nights with her, then he left. And then come Tuesday, maybe I don't know if you're old enough, but to me, this reminds me of the Popeye cartoon, I'll gladly pay you Tuesday for a hamburger today. Readers could Google that. So she waited till Tuesday, and then she opened up the closet, the cabinet, and there were no gold coins. And she said, oh my goodness, what have I done? So she quickly sent word to her husband to come home from wherever he was. He came back and he freaked out. And they went to the rabbi and said, what do we do? And the rabbi appealed to the highest authority in Germany at the time, and that was Rabbi Yaakov Edlinger, the Binyan Siyan, the Aruch Lener, And he first he quotes a Maharik, and he says, okay, look, it was infidelity, but it was not intentional. She thought she was doing a mitzvah. She thought she was giving birth to Mashiach and bringing the Geula, and at the same time...
We know what happened to the last woman, was it 2,000 years ago or something, who tried doing that, right?
it does not turn out well.
Not learn her lesson. Okay.
So the Rabbi Yaakov Edlinger says, you know, based on the Maharik, they have to get divorced. They can't remain married. She committed infidelity.
Wow.
And the husband believes her. Yeah, there was no proof, but the husband believed her, and that raises other questions, other problems. However, says the Binyan Sin, you know, maybe we don't paskin like this Maharik. Maybe we can distinguish between a case where a woman commits the infidelity for her own pleasure, for her own hana, but she thinks it's mutter for whatever reason. Her kala teacher never taught her. So if she's doing it for the sake of her own pleasure, so that he accepts the Maharik's rule that's considered mola vomal, she's betraying her husband. But if she's doing it for a mitzvah, that's not a betrayal. That he said that maybe the Maharik is wrong on that, and that's actually a mitzvah. It's not a betrayal. It's not an amazed. The show gig, maybe not even an isser at all.
Though she was, you know, completely gullible, completely misled, nonetheless, her intentions were lofty, and it would not constitute znus. It would not constitute adultery. That's the argument.
That's the argument. And we want to keep families together. You wouldn't want to punish someone for being naive. Sometimes there are real life consequences for being naive. Whether it comes from investing in a fraudulent investment, you're not getting your money back. Right. And the same, there are spiritual consequences to being naive also. But we want to find if there is a place in halacha to be mekel, we want to find that place. And the Binyan Sin, you know, said we need to sharpen our pencils to try to keep this family together. And he believes he can make an argument like that if she believes she's doing a mitzvah, it's not considered infidelity.
It's interesting also, I think these cases presuppose that the husband himself, and I guess the wife also, after finding out what happened, wanted to remain together. Is that the background to all these tshuvas? Like, would these tshuvas even get off the ground if the husband himself said, we're done?
There would not be a question. Nobody would even ask the question. I believe, unless the woman refused to accept the get, and then it gets even more complicated. But the presumption here is, that you want to try to keep them together if they want to stay together. And that comes up with every case of infidelity. The spouse who's betrayed has to figure that out. And sometimes it's not always so simple. You got to go through a little counseling, a little soul searching, and a little discussing, you know, thinking about the bigger picture.
100%. And I'll reiterate, Rabbi Student, what you said earlier, which is, of course, we're talking about this academically from our literal armchairs. But right there, these are real cases that happen throughout the centuries. Today as well, there are real consequences, and obviously we care for everyone as human beings as well. That goes without saying. I'm curious: are there anything else we should be aware of the Maharik's tshuva? I know that you worked it into an essay about a defense that you made about Rabbi Jonathan Sacks. I'm not sure if you want to go down that route. We have about 5 minutes left, so what else should we know here?
So I do want to go back to that point because I think some people will think what you can learn halacha from pshat. And they'll start coming up with leniencies or wacky ideas. And one prerequisite before you even do that is you have to make sure that you're not contradicting anything in Chazal. And that takes a huge, you need broad shoulders in order to do that. You know, and anyone, any fifth grader can read a chumash, not any fifth grader, but hopefully a yeshiva trained fifth grader or eighth grader or 12th grader can read chumash and come up with an interesting pshat. But they have to know what else Chazal said everywhere else in order to connect it together and to say, I'm adding on to it with my simple understanding of the Chumash. Rav Avraham and Rambam could do that. Mm. I don't think I could do that. I don't think most of the listeners here, if any, can do that either. But it is something interesting to think about. The Netziv, in his commentary, Hamik Davar, he actually does that quite often. It's fascinating how he does that. I don't know if you want to talk about one example.
We have a few minutes left. We could go for an example.
There's a question of, let's say someone is a bit sick, and the doctors say you can fast one day, but not too much. So after Rosh Hashanah comes Tzom Gedaliah, and the doctors say if you fast on Tzom Gedaliah, you're not going to be strong enough to fast on Yom Kippur. So you can either fast on Tzom Gedaliah and not on Yom Kippur, or wait until Yom Kippur, you know, eat on Tzom Gedaliah and then fast on Yom Kippur. Which should you do? And that's not a simple question to answer. You know, some posts can say, well, the mitzvah's here, just do it, and worry about the future when the future comes. And others say, well, you gotta be a little realistic and realize Yom Kippur is more important. So just eat on Tzom Gedaliah. So the Netziv learns from a question in a story of Aaron during a plague, how I think it was after the Meraglim, how he took the Machtos, the plates from the Mizbeach and brought an incense, the Ketores, out into the middle of the plague. Exactly the details of how he did that, the Netziv learns that he deduces from that, just from the story, yes, he understood it, the narrative of the Chumash, that if there's a suffix of whether there will be Pikuach Nefesh or not, you wait till the Pikuach Nefesh comes. And then you deal with it. But if there's no suffix, if it's Vaday, if it will definitely come, then you have to plan accordingly now. Oh. So depending on the doctor's advice, if you're definitely not going to be able to fast Yom Kippur, then you don't fast on Tzom Gedaliah. But if it's maybe, we'll see, then fast on Tzom Gedaliah.
So another relatively high stakes area of halacha being supported by an inference from a story, from a narrative portion of the Chumash.
It's a pele. It blows my mind. I wouldn't have the guts to do that. And I don't, you know, but everything in Torah has to connect. Even the pshat has to connect to everything. And we can't just, you know, pardon off some of our brain and, you know, say, oh, that's pshat. That's a lot. It needs to work together.
It's holistic. It's all part of one Torah. Though I do wonder, it's common practice, as Chatani Maskir Hayom, and people in my line of work as pulpit rabbis, we get up there on Shabbos morning and, you know, maybe we read a pasuk one way. I'm like, here's a nice little idea that I thought in the pasuk, and then I'm going to share it with everyone based on my preconceived message that I want to get across anyway. But like what you're saying, when it comes to halacha, maybe, I don't know, maybe it should be the same when it comes to agada as well. Maybe I can't make a mechudashtik assertion and reading of a pasuk unless I actually know the vast literature. And those who are looking online on YouTube, you can see all the books that are lying the shelves behind rabbi students. Maybe until I've read all those books, who am I to start making up my own pshatim sukkim? Even if there's no halakhic ramifications.
Yeah, well, to some degree, you're right. And we have to think about what the stakes are. And sometimes in Agada, the stakes are high. When we're talking about Hashkafa, we're talking about theology, the stakes are high. When we're talking about Halacha, the stakes are also high. When the stakes aren't so high, you're trying to say a drush, you know. The general Ein Meshivin Al HaDrush. You know, someone says a drush, okay, we don't challenge it. He can say what he wants.
Right, you could reinterpret the Bible based on new gender sensitivities, right? It's all free for all.
The stakes, like I said, when the stakes are high, you got to be rigorous. When the stakes aren't so high, we, you know, a rabbi has to give a drush every Shabbos. We, you know, we cut him a little slack.
Right. I think someone once made a comic. It was one of these, you know, memes that they have on Twitter, as you see, and Facebook and other places. It shows someone kind of like with a meat grinder, and he puts a Pirkei Avos in there. Something comes out and says, whatever I was going to say anyway. So, you know, I wonder almost like, are we using agadic literature to say what we were going to say anyway, but with extra flair and now the authority of Chazal behind it? That's a bit of a concern. I wonder about myself when I give a drasha.
There's a footnote in Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky's Emes LeYaakov, towards the end of Brachos, I forget exactly where, where he says just that. He says, when you see a drush, you're not seeing what Chumash is trying to tell us, what Chazal is trying to tell us. You're seeing what the speaker is trying to tell us, wow, using the Chumash and the Midrash as his tools.
So, and that's okay.
He doesn't. He leaves it without judgment, which I think means to be, it's okay. Just take it as the opinion of the speaker for what it's worth.
Right. Wow. So this is, you know, I'm glad we got in this little bit of discussion at the end also. So Rabbi Student, I really appreciate all of the amazing things you shared with us with the Maharik, the other tshuvos, and also what it has to do with Haggadah. In just our last minute or so, do you want to just tell us about any other future projects you're working on? I know you're doing so many amazing things with Torah Musings. And I know you have a special Sefer celebrating 20 years coming out. What can we be looking forward to in the future from you?
So I want to mention one other thing that I'm working on, and it is, thank you for mentioning the book that should be coming out in a few months, hopefully. I'm working with a programmer, a really, really talented app developer, who created something called Torah App, one word, no spaces, which pulls together Sfarim translations and Shiurim from OU Torah, from YU Torah, from Sefaria, puts it all together. I'm sort of the rabbinic advisor, making sure that everything is kosher or orthodox there. But it's an amazing tool. The guy is so talented that I use it on my, let's say when I go for a drive and I want to listen to 2 minute Divrei Torah or 10 minute Shiurim, it automatically lets me binge listen, go from one to the next to the next. Wow. And it has English translation along with the Gemara and the Rishonim and the Achronim. It's an incredible tool, and it's called Torah App. I encourage people to check it out.
Okay, thank you so much, and maybe we'll put a link in the description for that. And Rabbi Student, it's such a huge schus. I always learn from you, usually via written word. It's a pleasure to have you share your Torah Shabbal Peh with us, and God willing, looking forward to all the many different ways of learning from you going forward in the future as well.
Thank you so much. I wish you hasachal with your family and your community and your shul, and continue growing and doing wonderful things.
Shkayach v'chein l'mam. Thank you for listening to Shoot First, Ask Questions Later. Please make sure to subscribe to get the latest updates. And if you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to rate us and leave a review. Do you have a response to the response that you want to share on the show? Please send your letter to the editor to MitchellMKurtz@gmail.com. And God willing, we would love to consider your perspective to be shared on a future episode. This is Moshe Kurtz, and I look forward to reviewing more responses with you next time on Shoot First, Ask Questions Later.